Good afternoon and welcome to today's special luncheon meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the San Francisco Hilton Hotel. I'm Skip Rhodes, President-elect of the Commonwealth Club, and your chair today. We also welcome the viewers of C-SPAN television, as well as listeners over the Commonwealth Club nationwide radio network, joining us for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners and viewers here in San Francisco, as well as those joining us on television and radio, to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speaker. He has been a senior advisor to three presidents and twice been a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. Born in Washington and a graduate of Georgetown University and Columbia University, at the age of 23, he became the youngest editorial writer on a major newspaper in America while at the St. Louis Globe Dispatch, the St. Louis Globe Democrat, from 1962 to 1965. From 1966 to 1969, he was executive assistant to Richard Nixon and served as senior advisor to President Nixon from 1969 through Nixon's final days of Watergate in 1974. On leaving the White House, our speaker became a syndicated columnist and founding father of three of the most enduring shows in television, The McLaughlin Group, Capital Gang, and Crossfire. In 1985, he was selected as communications director for President Ronald Reagan. He challenged George Bush for the Republican nomination in 1992 when he almost won an upset victory in the New Hampshire primary. In 1996, he came back to win the New Hampshire primary and received 3 million Republican votes in that year's primaries. He has written five books, including Right from the Beginning, about growing up in the nation's capital, and his 1998 book on U.S. trade policy, The Great Betrayal, How American Sovereignty and Social Justice Are Being Sacrificed to the Gods of the Global Economy. Our speaker is mounting a third campaign for the presidency, and from his remarks yesterday leading up to his address today, he will take a serious look at American foreign policy, particularly in relation to what he sees as the failure of our policy of engagement with the People's Republic of China. I am pleased to welcome Mr. Patrick J. Buchanan, conservative commentator and Republican presidential candidate. Mr. Buchanan.
Thank you very much, Skip. It is a pleasure to be here. I understand you had Mr. George Stephanopoulos here on Friday. I debated George Friday night, and I'm going to debate him Monday night. And so I'll tell you from the beginning, today's speech will be a Monica-free zone. You know, after I won New Hampshire, there was a real possibility I could win Arizona, in which case I would have won the Republican nomination. And during a year of wall-to-wall Monica on Crossfire and the McLaughlin Group, after that was over, I was asked by a reporter, you know, Pat, you've been pretty tough on Clinton, but what would you have done if you had won Arizona, gone on to win the nomination, and you had the Monica problem in the White House? How would you have handled it? I said, well, if it had been me, it would have been relatively easy, because I would have been lying flat on my back in a pool of blood, looking up at my wife, Shelley, who would be saying, honey, how do I reload this thing? You know, I was not involved in Monica Gate except as a journalist, but I have been, and I was a survivor of the two previous largest scandals in American history. And that, of course, is Iran-Contra and Watergate. And I served with Richard Nixon from the beginning of Watergate right to the end in his White House. And I must tell you a story about that, about an introduction far less gracious than the one I just got. It was late in the Watergate episode, 1974, after my colleagues and friends Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Colson and Mitchell and Chapin and others had all gone off to their separate minimum security facilities. I was invited to address a Ivy League campus, one of those Tony Ivy League campuses up in the Northeast. And the young assistant professor who introduced me said to me before he got up, "Mr. Buchanan, this is going to be a very brief introduction." And he got up in front of the audience and said, "Students, please welcome the only member of Richard Nixon's inner circle who could have traveled all this distance without first consulting his parole officer." So I know what they went through in the last year. But I want to talk today about a very serious subject, and that subject is U.S.-China relations on the eve of the visit of Mr. Zhu Rongji to the United States, which begins, I believe, tomorrow in Los Angeles. Now, in the decade that has elapsed since the last visit of a Chinese premier to the United States, a great deal has happened that is indeed troubling and downright alarming. 10 years ago this June, a very frightened Chinese regime that had watched students shake governments all across Eastern Europe, communist governments, decided this was not going to happen in the People's Republic of China. So the tanks of the People's Liberation Army were sent to disperse students in Tiananmen Square for the crime of having demanded democratic reforms beneath a replica of the Statue of Liberty. We do not yet know how many perished in the subsequent massacre. 17 years before that atrocity in 1972, I rode through that same square with Richard Milhouse Nixon. I am one of 10 surviving members of the official delegation that opened up the People's Republic of China. So my experience with China goes back a long way. And let me give you my views. America should not seek any conflict or confrontation with China, nor do we seek some Sino-American Cold War to replace the U.S.-Soviet Cold War that has just ended. Nor did I oppose the rapprochement that was pursued by Presidents Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush, asking only that it be done with our eyes open. For we have to realize that the aging men who now rule the People's Republic of China were young apparatchiks in the regime of Mao Zedong, arguably the greatest mass murderer of the 20th century, a rival to Hitler and Stalin. Now, President Clinton's initial determination to re-engage with China after Tiananmen Square also seemed to me to be worth the effort, because Beijing controls 22% of the world's population and possesses nuclear weapons. We cannot ignore China, and we cannot isolate China. But our vision, America's vision of the Asia-Pacific region, is one of peace, prosperity, and independence for all nations. And we cannot embrace as a friend and a partner a mighty and expansionist power openly hostile to the ideas of human dignity and freedom on which this country was founded. As a Pacific power, we have interest in Asia, which we cannot permit to be imperiled, and old friends and allies whom we cannot allow to be bullied or subjugated. It is thus a time for truth about our relations with China, about the People's Republic, and about the Clinton policy toward China. In my judgment, in a sentence, the Clinton policy of constructive engagement has degenerated into willful self-delusion and craven appeasement. And that policy is leading directly to a confrontation and possibly a violent conflict with China in the coming century. Now, we did not seek this collision with China. In the last decade, America has actually sought to mollify China. Since 1990, Beijing has been allowed to run up $274 billion worth of trade surpluses with the United States. Those surpluses have enabled China to compile the second largest hoard of hard currency on earth, besides Japan, $150 billion. Last year alone, China was allowed to run a $57 billion trade surplus with the United States, an enormous some. The U.S. has provided Beijing, or voted to provide Beijing, with Asian Development Bank loans and World Bank loans, and given Beijing access to our latest technology, including supercomputers. Since 1990, moreover, America has reduced its own strategic missile arsenal and cut conventional forces by the equivalent of the entire land, air, and sea forces that we sent to fight Desert Storm. Defense spending that consumes 6% of America's GDP back in the Reagan era now consumes only 3% of America's GDP, the lowest level since before Pearl Harbor. Ronald Reagan built up his famous 600-ship Navy. Parts of that patrolled the Asian coast and the China coast. That's been slashed almost in half, closer to 300 ships. But what have been the fruits of this policy of mollifying China and engaging with China? China has provided missiles to Iran and nuclear technology to Pakistan. Chinese naval forces have occupied Mischief Reef, which is in the 200-mile limit of the Philippines, in the Spratly Islands, which sit astride the oil lifeline to Japan. China has fired missiles at Taiwan to intimidate that government and to disrupt its free elections. China has warned Japan against any deeper military cooperation with the United States and warned that any deployment of a missile defense would be an unfriendly act, as would any missile defense of Japan or Taiwan. China has launched the greatest military buildup that Asia has seen since Japan in the 1930s, and is using these enormous surpluses from its trade surplus with the United States to buy the latest in Russian missiles and anti-ship weapons, with the complicity or the laxity of the White House. China has stolen U.S. satellite and missile technology and the technology for the W-88 miniaturized nuclear warhead, and it has targeted 13 of its first 18 long-range ballistic missiles on the United States of America. China has ignored our protest to pursue cultural genocide in Tibet and persecute Roman Catholics, evangelical Christians, and political dissidents. This cruel regime forces abortions and sterilizations on women for the crime, married women, for the crime of wanting to have a second child, echoes of Germany in the 30s. Now, to those who say China's internal policies are its own business, I reply that as Beijing treats its own defenseless citizens, so it will treat us if ever we allow our defenses to atrophy and decline. Mr. Clinton's decision not to allow human rights considerations to interfere with the profits of trade seems to me, in retrospect, to have been a shameless capitulation. Americans, I believe, are being true neither to themselves nor their heritage as the champions of freedom and decency if they engage in business as usual with tyrants who trample upon all that we profess to hold sacred. For Americans, there must always be something still greater in the hierarchy of values than the bottom line on a balance sheet. It is time to put country before commerce and let America be America again. Last year, President Clinton went to Beijing and proclaimed China now to be our strategic partner, and returned to tell us that China had retargeted those missiles away from the United States. But what has been China's record since? According to the U.S. Department of State, China's human rights record deteriorated sharply last year. Even Mr. Clinton now seeks to have China condemned by the UN Commission on Human Rights. Here's a bill of particulars on Beijing's recent persecution agenda. In Jiangxi province, 76-year-old Roman Catholic bishop Zheng Jingmu is serving 3 years in a labor camp for the crime of saying Mass without permission. In Shandong, police broke up a Protestant worship service and arrested most of the 61 worshipers. Many are serving 12-year sentences in prison. In Tibet, 14 Buddhist nuns serving up to 9 years in prison had 9 years added to their sentences for recording pro-independence songs while in prison. Last fall, when dissidents tried to register a new democratic party in China, 30 organizers were arrested. The leaders are serving 13 years in prison. Now, a great power that is frightened of such peaceful challenges to its power and legitimacy is both unhealthy and dangerous. China has also expanded to 200 the number of M9 and M11 missiles that are now targeted on Taiwan. It is building toward a force of 650 missiles to target on Taiwan, according to the Pentagon, and China has mock test fired longer range missiles at U.S. forces in South Korea, Okinawa, Japan, and as far out as Guam. Now, how threatening are these missiles? Here is a reading of America's Maginot Line, which was in December's Atlantic Monthly. With 45 missiles, writes Paul Bracken, China could virtually close Taiwan's ports, airfields, waterworks, and power plants, and destroy the oil storage facilities of a nation that needs continual replenishment from the outside world. What is China doing? Quite simply, China is building the missile capacity to paralyze Taiwan. And because U.S. bases in Asia are utterly naked to missile attack, these bases are becoming as much hostages against U.S. action as they are centers of American power. Missile strikes against these soft targets, is how Bracken describes the U.S. bases, could wreak havoc, destroy airfields, fuel dumps, and weapons and ammunition depots. Under missile fire, he says, American bases in the Far East could be rendered useless. What is China up to? Now, the answer seems clear and ominous. In 1996, when the United States sent two aircraft carriers off the coast of China and Taiwan, China had only 30 to 50 missiles aimed at Taiwan and no air force capable of challenging the U.S. Seventh Fleet. Beijing dissolved the crisis. But China is now clearly preparing for a second crisis in the Taiwan Straits to force Taiwan back to, quote, the embrace of the motherland. And it intends to use the threat of a missile blockade if Taiwan resists. And if the U.S. Seventh Fleet intervenes, China this time intends to have the air, sea, and missile capacity to put at risk every U.S. warship of the Seventh Fleet and every American base in the Far East. This confrontation may still be a few years away, but China is clearly, unmistakably preparing for it. And if we do not act to prevent it, I believe there is a near certainty it is coming. Now, this is where the unrequited appeasement of China has left the next president. In the words of the Asian scholar Arthur Waldron of the University of Pennsylvania, quote, U.S. policy has smoothed the way for an ultranationalist dictatorship in China, even as U.S. security failures have ensured that that dictatorship will have state-of-the-art weapons. The Clinton-China policy, I believe, is a failure. Yet the president refuses to see it or concede it and seems determined to maintain his rosy view of what China is all about. And frankly, in their failure to renounce Clinton's China policy, Republicans, too, are embracing some old myths about China. The first is the utopian belief that peace comes on the wings of trade. As long as we trade with China, it is said, we need never confront China. History, however, reveals this notion to be bunk. The bloodiest war of the 19th century was fought inside a single free trade zone between the United States of America and the Confederate States of America. In the 1930s, Japan's best customers on earth were China and the United States. She attacked both. during the Battle of Britain, Nazi Germany's reliable supplier of grain and gasoline was Stalin's Russia. As soon as the Battle of Britain was over, Hitler turned on his trading partner. The Chinese market, visions of which so intoxicate our business roundtable in Washington and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, is an enduring myth that dates all the way back to the open door policy of Secretary of State John Hay in 1900, when he proclaimed an open door. At that time, American big business, with its foothold in the Philippines, slavered over the idea of 400 million customers for American goods in China. What was the result? How did big business benefit? Where China accounted for 1% of U.S. trade in 1900, that figure soared to 2% by 1930, with most of that in tobacco sales and cigarettes. So much for the great China market. The truth, China has never been an important export market for the United States of America. We sell more to tiny Singapore than we sell to China. Last year, less than 2% of our exports went to communist China. But China ran up enormous surpluses with us in the sale of electrical equipment, heavy machinery, footwear, furniture, apparel, clothing, leather, and plastics. Now, besides aircraft, what were America's big sellers to China? What were the commodities and goods that we sold that China bought in volume? Let me list them in ascending order of importance. Cotton, live animals, starches, fibers, meats, cereals, wood pulp, raw hides, skins, residue, waste from the food industry, oil seeds, animal and vegetable fat, and fertilizers. Lots and lots of fertilizer. Now, isn't that pretty much what the 13 colonies used to send to George III? We are sending the kind of commodities colonies send to a mother country, to China. So let me repeat. The China market is a myth. Beijing tailors its trade policy to augment state power. It buys what it needs and cannot produce, such as Boeing planes, while stealing U.S. technology to create its own airframe industry. Now, I understand, having studied trade policy for years, exactly what China is doing. They're pursuing a policy of economic nationalism. I don't understand what America is doing. America, trade policy today is impossible to defend in terms of the national interest of the United States. For example, we impose economic sanctions on democratic India for testing nuclear weapons to deter China, which has attacked India twice. But when Beijing steals our nuclear technology and targets its missiles on the United States of America, we declare China to be our strategic partner. When Haitian generals violate human rights, they get invaded. When communist China becomes the greatest violator of human rights on earth, a prison camp of 1 billion people, they get a $57 billion trade surplus. But the administration, which has all its political capital wagered on the China card, there may be no turning back. That would require an admission that its policy had failed. And administrations of either party don't readily do that. But it is time that the Congress renounced a Clinton policy that is leading to a confrontation while it strengthens Beijing for that confrontation. What should be done? First, until China closes its concentration camps, stops the coercive abortions, and ceases persecuting Christians, Tibetans, and dissidents, Congress should suspend MFN and impose on all Chinese imports the identical taxes that they impose on exports from the United States of America to China. Second, Congress should block the transfer of any new high technology, military technology, to the Chinese regime. Third, Congress should demand that the administration veto any new World Bank or Asian Development Bank loans to China and reject the admission of Communist China to the World Trade Organization and work to bring in Taiwan, which is a friend of the United States with whom we have far more trade, at least exports, than China. Fourth, the Republican Party should declare its intent to shift the center of gravity of U.S.-Asia policy away from Asia's dictators and toward Asia's Democrats. As America is an island nation and the Pacific is our frontier, we must begin to restore the U.S. Navy to the preeminence it had under President Reagan. A decade of slashing defense for social programs and using the American military for social experiments by 1960s radicals must come to an end. Finally, I believe the United States must assert that any decision to deploy purely defensive weapons, such as the theater missile defense, is not subject to Beijing's veto. And if Beijing does not halt its own offensive missile buildup, we should terminate normal trade. An embargo on China would hardly be felt by America, but the impact on China would be immediate, an instant devaluation of its currency and an instant collapse of its economy. Let me repeat, no one wants a confrontation or a conflict with China. Our war, the Cold War, is over. But Beijing needs to be jolted into an awareness that threats against Taiwan or our friends in the Pacific mean an end to economic engagement and a closing of the American market. In the 6th century BC, Chinese General Sun Tzu wrote, "The opportunity to defeat the enemy is provided by the enemy himself." Today, China is dependent on U.S. trade and goodwill for loans, for yearly infusions of hard currency, and for virtually its entire economic growth. In this relationship today, the United States retains the whip hand. We will not have it for too much longer. So now is the time to use our economic leverage to demonstrate to Beijing forcefully the cost of going down the road to confrontation over Taiwan, so that further down this road, it will not be necessary to use our military power and put at risk our fleets, our bases, and now even our cities. General MacArthur said half a century ago that those who would appease China are blind to history's clear lesson. There is no instance, he said, where appeasement has led to other than a sham peace. Now, we do not want a sham peace with China. We want real peace. But real peace requires a clarity of vision and a firmness of purpose that are absent today from our China policy since that awful June night when those tanks rolled through Tiananmen Square. A confrontation with China or a conflict with China, I repeat, is avoidable. But this administration must stop turning a blind eye to China's belligerent encroachment, or that confrontation is going to become inevitable. Let us do what we can to avert that day and that possibility. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Pat Buchanan, candidate for the Republican Party nomination for president, for your remarks here today. Now, Dr. Julius Crevins, president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session. Julie?
Thank you, Skip Rhodes, our chair for today, Mr. Buchanan. We have a large number of questions for you. Let's begin.
I can take some with me on home. I'll maybe write the responses.
Would you characterize China as a world superpower or a nation that will inevitably become a superpower?
China is today a mighty regional power, not yet a global superpower. It does not have the economy for that. It does not have the global reach militarily that the United States has or the Soviet Union had. But clearly, China is a great nation of the future, undeniably so, unless there is some internal collapse that happens that is right now unanticipated. It is not a superpower yet, but it is on the way.
Please list two or three specific policies of the Chinese government and how you would expect to change them using U.S. military force, economic pressure, or other approaches you feel would be effective.
Let's take two. The most dangerous recently has been the tremendous proliferation of Chinese short-range missiles targeted on Taiwan. They had 30 to 50 in 1996, and they're now up to 200, and according to a Pentagon report, they're building to 650. I can't see any other purpose of that kind of missile force unless it is to intimidate and threaten and coerce Taiwan or attack Taiwan. So what I would say to the Chinese, if you do not put an immediate hold on those and you do not stop discriminating against American goods coming into China's markets, we will put instantly on you the same tariffs and taxes that you put on us. Now, China could not survive that economically. That's an economic pressure. I would not threaten China militarily. No one wants a war with China. She has not directly threatened our vital interest. But this is one of those ominous buildups you see, as we saw in the 1930s in Japan and then in Germany, which are going to lead to confrontation unless you deal with them early. So I would use economic and diplomatic weaponry exclusively now. But if China continues that buildup, it seems to me clearly they have the objective of using force if necessary to bring Taiwan back and to use force if necessary to prevent us from intervening. I can't see any other conclusion from what they're doing. So that's why I would say move diplomatically and economically now and sort of a sharp rebuff to what they've done, but no military confrontation now.
Can any pro-life candidate win in 2000?
Yes, I can.
Are you endorsing that America police countries that fail human relations tests and use military power to try and change things in China, Libya, Africa, etc.?
No, I am not. I've been derided as an isolationist, which I am not. America's never been an isolationist nation. I do believe that the United States has to stand for human rights and human dignity and against, and really cannot, as John F. Kennedy once said, we give an embrace to small d Democrats, and we've got to shake the hands of dictators around the world. I don't think the United States should go around the world trying to reform nations or police other nations. But I do think this, that if a nation treats its own people barbarically and then looks us in the eye and says, we are America's friends, it is lying to us. Because nations that treat their people like that are really spitting on our values and what we fundamentally believe, and we ought to be wary of nations like that. So what I would say in terms of trade policy and association, if you've got countries like China and Great Britain and Australia and even Japan, with whom I've got some disagreements on trade, that basically respect human rights and traditions, you treat them one way and you treat another way nations that disrespect human rights. And I think here, your Congresswoman, Nancy Pelosi, and I are in full agreement. There's a Republican back there that objected.
If your bid for the Republican nomination does not catch fire by time of the California primary, will you withdraw and support the nomination to avoid splitting the grand old party?
Well, that, of course, is an impossibility. Let me say this. I am in the race. And last time, we won three out of the first four contests. And I think if we'd won just one more, I would have won the nomination. But we were defeated in Arizona. But I'll say this. It is my present determination to stay in the race, at least until California, because California, which I think is a good thing, comes only 2 weeks after New Hampshire. And then let the race for California, New York, and Florida, it's basically a national primary almost, that's going to be held 2 weeks after New Hampshire. That will tell us the relative strength of all the candidates in the party, But those who say split the party, I would remind folks that I have endorsed every Republican candidate since I came into politics in Goldwater in 1960, even when my candidate, Reagan in 96 or 76, Buchanan in 92 and 96, lost the nomination. And I would anticipate that. And quite frankly, it was not me who kept people out of the Republican convention in 96. It was them who sent me up to Escondido and wouldn't let me speak. So we've been very, very gracious on this, and we would hope to be so again.
If you were president, how would you handle the Kosovo crisis?
If I were president, we wouldn't be in the Kosovo crisis. I think this is a terrible blunder that's been made by NATO and the United States of America. What had happened in Yugoslavia after the Berlin Wall came down is basically the collapse of the central communist government of Yugoslavia. Understandably, the various component elements of Yugoslavia, all of which were put together in 1919 at Versailles into one country, the country of the South Slavs, Yugoslavia, began to break away. Slovenia broke away. Macedonia broke away. Croatia broke away. Bosnia broke away. And now Kosovo's breaking away, and Vojvodina's going to break away, and Montenegro's going to break away. Now, when these things happen, just like the British Empire unraveling in the Middle East or in the subcontinent, they can be very bloody. And it seems to me the interest of the United States and of Europe was not of any particular arrangement, but diminishing the bloodshed and violence there. And I think the United States, by threatening the airstrikes, convincing Mr. Milosevic that he was going to lose Kosovo at Rambouillet, he made a decision when he found that out to grab as much of it as he could and to push the people out of that territory that he wasn't going to let go. And so I think, in a way, we created this crisis, and the American airstrikes have clearly exacerbated the crisis. The number of refugees has been enormous since the bombing began. So I think it was a mistake to do what we did, and politicians are not willing to admit to mistakes. But let me say historically, I was in Reagan's White House. He put the troops in Lebanon for a good purpose. He was going to stabilize the Christian government there and support a pro-Western government. He didn't put enough troops in. The objective was too hazy. You couldn't do that with 2,000 Marines. But when the Marines were killed in that horrible atrocity, Reagan did not say, okay, I made a mistake, but I'm going to cover it up by putting 100,000 in there. He pulled out and said, in effect said, without admitting it, we made the mistake. But he pulled out, and he did not compound it. Jack Kennedy at the Bay of Pigs was a debacle, but he didn't send 300,000 troops into Cuba to repair the damage done. So I think and I pray that the United States does not send 100,000 or 200,000 ground troops into Kosovo in Yugoslavia, as some are recommending, simply to save the face of the people who made this mistake or save the credibility of an alliance which should never have put its credibility on the line in the first place.
Given that President Clinton has co-opted Republican historic issues, what do you believe are the issues the Republican candidate in 2000 should embrace?
Well, Bill Clinton is an extraordinarily capable and successful politician. And he has co-opted, for example, the crime issue. He's tough on the death penalty, which, as you know, in California is very controversial and majorities support it. He's constantly photographed with police. He has co-opted a number of these issues and a lot of the smaller issues, you know, school uniforms and things, which naturally appeal to conservatives. But the Republican problem is not so much Clinton as it is we are the victims of our own success. Now, the great cause of my life that brought me into journalism and politics was the Cold War. I thought that the conflict between the Soviet Communist Empire, which was worldwide, and the United States and its allies was the great cause of my life. That united all conservatives, social conservatives, economic conservatives, neoconservatives, all of us in a great coalition. And many Democrats supported that. But we won the Cold War under Reagan's leadership, and the Soviet Empire collapsed. Reagan said, we're going to cut taxes to get the economy moving. He cut taxes from 70% to 28% or 26%. You can't get much lower than that. The economy is going gangbusters. So it's very tough to go back to the old formulas. And I would tell my conservative friends that while we admire and revere Ronald Reagan and his approach to politics and what he accomplished, this is not 1980. This is 2000. And the challenges to us are far different than those that challenged Ronald Reagan when I was with him in 76 and 80 and then 84 and 85. It is a new world. And it seems to me that the issues on which I am running are different than many Republicans, as they will be quick to remind you. But one of them is, I think these trade policies we've manifest are not only deindustrializing America, they're turning us into two countries, where folks who used to depend on manufacturing jobs as the yellow brick road to the middle class are finding that road is closed. And a lot of us are doing extraordinarily well, and the incomes are unbelievable, but there's greater economic and income diversity in America than any country in the Western world. That is an issue. A foreign policy that puts our own country first and keeps American soldiers out of battlefields where no vital interest of America is engaged is another issue. But on this, Republicans, too, disagree. So we've got a lot of issues on which Republicans disagree. And I think what's going to happen in America is basically creation of new coalitions where some of the Republican coalition moves over to the Democrats and some Democrats, working class and middle class, and Reform Party folks move back to the Republicans, and we have a more populist, conservative, traditionalist party on the one hand, and a more establishment, internationalist, globalist party, Democratic Party, on the other. I think that's what's coming.
How do you differ from the libertarian thinking?
Well, on foreign policy, there are many libertarians to whom I am very close. The late Murray Rothbard was a wonderful friend of mine. And he was one of the leading libertarians. I think most libertarians agree with me of the down at the Cato Institute on foreign policy that they believe in a strong America and a strong foreign policy, but one which does not go to war unless vital American interests are engaged or vital allies are attacked, and that keeps us out of these battles, very much in the tradition of Washington and the Founding Fathers all the way up to the Spanish-American War. So they would agree with me there. Where they disagree with me is on trade policy. Quite obviously, they believe in global free trade. But in my view, a global free trade zone, like the United States of America and like the European Union, will call into existence a government over top of it. And if you have global free trade, we're going to have world government. And I am opposed to that as I am opposed to anything. On social issues, libertarians are very divided. Most of them are for basically decriminalizing narcotics. Some of them decriminalizing prostitution and things like that. And some of them are pro-choice on abortion. So I would disagree with, I guess, the majority of them on those issues. I'm much more of a traditionalist conservative.
Why are you anti-Semitic?
Well, this is a charge that I believe, this is a smear that is designed to silence individuals and to smear them because they have taken stands which folks disagree with. Now, I very strongly supported the Roman Catholic convent at Auschwitz. I don't think it was an affront or an outrage. And I defended a fellow who was indicted as the greatest war criminal of the Nazi era, John Demjanjuk. And after 10 years of defending him, before he was about to be hanged in Jerusalem, thankfully the Soviet Empire collapsed and the evidence came out that I was right. It was a case of mistaken identity. And I have said, and I will say again, that I believe any peace and security for Israel requires that justice be done to the Palestinian people. And that means a homeland, a state, a flag, and a nation of their own, besides the state of Israel. And anyone who makes those statements and takes the stands I do will receive the same abuse I do. But that's what you take in public life when you take controversial stands.
Many of our current news programs take the form of spirited, entertaining confrontation. Is this good or bad for the public's need to understand issues?
Well, here I do bear a full measure of responsibility. I am a founding father of Crossfire, Capital Gang, and the McLaughlin Group, three of the most enduring of these shows. I think that these shows very much accord in a lot of ways with the temper of our times, and at their best, good-spirited argument and debate, they replicate what goes on in living rooms and what goes on in bar rooms at their best. But there's problems, no doubt about it, that sometimes we get what we call crosstalk. Everyone talking at once, and I'm as exasperated as that as anyone else. But I think it is more honest debate on, for example, I mean, Crossfire cannot continue to get a million or more listeners every night for 17 years. The McLaughlin Group is the most popular television show in America, I believe, even more so than Meet the Press. If they didn't deliver something that people interested in ideas and issues really wanted. Now, so I will be here to defend that. But I do think in some cases now we're getting, frankly, some of the sleaziness in television and some of them that are going downhill in terms of personal attacks and what they were doing during this miserable last year made me wonder, quite frankly, if I would really be in journalism, go into journalism again if I had to do it all over again. But I don't think the shows I've been on, I know they have been argumentative, and a lot of women especially say, you know, I was watching it last night, I had to get up and leave the room. But usually their husbands say, you really gave it to him, Pat. Good for you.
Education is an important issue to the electorate. Is there a role for the federal government in education? What is it?
Well, the federal role, in my judgment, should be pretty much restricted to higher education. In other words, the scholarships, Pell Grants, and things like this, where a student, say, who grew up in California might want to go east to Massachusetts to school, obviously that's going to take a federal program if you're going to have that rather than a state program. Also, there are many of your universities which do research which the federal government wants done. But in primary and secondary education, in my judgment, the federal role and the intrusion of federal bureaucrats and federal judges in the last 35 years has helped precipitate a disaster in public education. In 1964, the test scores were infinitely higher than they are today. And it's not simply because more kids are taking the tests. In terms of kids who are reaching the top levels, whatever it is on the SAT scores, they've had to rejigger the scholastic aptitude tests because they're not getting enough hitting the highest level. I think that the federal judges and federal bureaucrats ought to be removed from education. All the education funds at the primary and secondary level ought to be boxed up and sent back to Sacramento. And from there, they ought to be sent back to states and communities where these infinitely polarizing decisions over creationism and what's going to be taught about sex education are much better made at the local level democratically by folks at the PTA and principals and teachers. And so it's the only way to solve those problems. And quite frankly, it is parents and teachers at the local level who I believe are the most insistent upon reform and progress here. And so I would get the federal government out of education at the primary and secondary level entirely.
America has a long history of doing business as usual with dictators who trample on human rights, from General Pinochet in Chile to Mobutu in Zaire. Are your comments about China scaremongering tactics playing on yellow peril?
Well, I don't think so. I knew General Mobutu, and I met him in 1966 with Richard Nixon, and there's no doubt that General Mobutu was a thief. He looted so much money, I think it was his life's ambition to have more in the Swiss banks than King Leopold of Belgium, who had formerly ruled the Congo. So there's no doubt he was a thief and a bad man. As for General Pinochet, he took over from basically a Marxist regime, pro-Castroite regime, which was overthrown and legitimately, in my judgment, overthrown by the military there. There's no doubt it was very brutal how it was done in the first couple of years. Now, in terms of trade and in terms of a relationship, the relationship we had with General Pinochet and Mobutu and the Shah of Iran and other individuals whose reputation on human rights were less than savory were clearly designed because they were our allies in a great war which was going to decide the survival of Western civilization. You recall in the previous war, World War II, where Western civilization was at stake, FDR embraced Joseph Stalin, who was one of the most repulsive creatures ever to walk on the face of the earth, because he felt that was essential to win that war against Hitler. So statesmen and presidents have to deal with dreadful people. I went to China with Richard Nixon, and he shook hands with Mao Zedong. And Mao Zedong, estimates are that he killed up to 60 million human beings in these great revolutionary and cultural revolutions he had, appalling record. And we did it for a strategic reason. We were in Vietnam, and we wanted to get out, and we were faced with a huge military buildup in the Soviet Union, and we needed to counterbalance it. So all these considerations, you have to take into account all of these things. And if you read some of the people that write well, and religious people that write well on foreign policy, they will tell you that the decisions you make as a statesman are very often the lesser of two great evils. And that's what you're confronted with if you want your own people and your own nation to survive. But have we been basically in bed with or supportive of dictators and thugs? And the Clintonites, General Suharto, they gave him $41 billion. He killed 250,000 Roman Catholics in East Timor. Should we have bailed out his government or let it go under? So these are decisions that every president's got to make. And I guess you can, the gentleman sounds like he's more from the left if he's denouncing Pinochet, who is a very minor character compared to some of the monsters we've dealt with.
The United States is relying on cheap Chinese labor for assembling electronic components, clothing, and other products. How does that fit into your concept of the U.S. exporting low-tech commodities to China?
Well, I think my view of American economy is very Hamiltonian. When the Founding Fathers got together at Philadelphia in 1787, what concerned Hamilton and Washington and Madison in particular was the fact that the states, the independent nations basically, were putting tariffs on one another and claiming the Potomac River, and they were in constant economic battles with one another, and they saw the whole great experiment at liberty collapsing. And Hamilton's genius was to say, let us create a single free market among all 13 states, and we will finance the government that will build the roads and ports and canals to tie these states together with commerce. We will finance that by putting tariffs on the British goods entering the country so we become independent of the British goods, and the British merchants finance the building of the United States so we become economically independent, because they had come to believe that political independence wasn't going to survive without economic independence. And this is what so bothers me in the last 30 years. America is becoming economically dependent on foreign countries and Chinese workers and other workers for vital components of our economy. And I think we are allowing our independence to be lost here. So what I would do is devise a trade policy where we Americans depended more on one another, our minorities and working people, to produce the goods for the things that we enjoy, those of us who are well-to-do, rather than sending those good jobs over to China because they'll do them for 25 cents an hour. And I think we need a trade policy that looks to bringing this country together, because we all know there's an awful lot of forces that are tearing it apart right now.
Has the backlash over the impeachment of President Clinton made the Republican Party's presidential chances more remote?
Well, I think initially there's no doubt the Republicans paid a price for the impeachment process. But these things don't last very long in American politics now. I remember in 98 they said, you know, you fellows killed the tobacco tax and the American people want these cigarettes taxed. And in 3 weeks, people have forgotten the issue. And Americans have a very, very short memory, thankfully, on some things. But they're not going to be voting on 2 years from now on whether or not. Can anybody here now name all 10 senators, Republicans, who voted to exonerate Clinton on the charge of perjury? I don't think so. I don't think I can name them all. And so I think that's going to be very much, in some cases, Rogan and some of the more prominent Republicans. I mean, Lindsey Graham, quite frankly, I went down to South Carolina, and I think they want to make him king. So I'm not sure how many were seriously hurt by this.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where there's time for just one last question. Who do you think will be the Democratic candidate? Who would you prefer to run against?
Well, with Bill Bradley and Al Gore, I think they're both charismatically challenged, as far as I can see. because Al Gore is a sleeper candidate in terms of people underestimate him. He won the debate with Ross Perot, and he won the debate with Jack Kemp, hands down. So, but I would like to debate Al Gore, I think. I think Al Gore is going to be the nominee, because Bill Bradley's a good man, but in order to overcome and beat an incumbent vice president like Gore, who is really strong in depth, you have to have either a cutting personality like a Jack Kennedy or a cutting issue, the way McGovern had the war issue and Barry Goldwater had the conservative issue. And I don't see that Bradley's got either. So unless something intrudes, we're going to be running against Al Gore. But I promise you this, if I'm in a debate with Al Gore, you will have to scalp tickets to that, because it will be an exciting debate, and I will not be looking at any watch halfway through that debate. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Patrick Buchanan, candidate for the Republican Party nomination for president, for speaking to us today. We also thank our audience here at the San Francisco Hilton Hotel, as well as those joining us on C-SPAN and the club's nationwide radio network. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.